This is Radio Stockdale.
Welcome to Radio Stockdale. I'm your host, Michael Sears, at the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership. My guest is Professor Mitt Regan. Mitt is McDivitt Professor of Jurisprudence, Director of the Center on Ethics and the Legal Profession, and Co-Director on the Center for National Security at Georgetown University Law Center. His work focuses on international law, national security, international human rights, legal and military ethics, and ethical issues relating to artificial intelligence. Professor Regan is also a senior fellow at the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership here at the Naval Academy. He has been a participant in major interdisciplinary projects on national security that include intelligence and national security, ethics, efficacy and accountability, global terrorism, and collective responsibility. Among several positions before joining Georgetown, Professor Regan served as law clerk to Justice William Brennan, Jr. on the U.S. Supreme Court and Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Welcome, Mitt, back to Radio Stockdale.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a pleasure to be on this wonderful program.
And you've been on this program a couple of different times, and I really appreciate all the opportunities we've had to talk to you. Today is going to be really focusing on this new thing we're talking about with Radio Stockdale, all about AI. And you've got significant experience across the board, but especially now relative to what I'll call targeting and the idea behind targeting using AI-enabled tools. Can you talk about the significance of viewing targeting as a process rather than this discrete act where you just find something and try to go and bomb it or take it out, especially in the context of AI-enabled weapons?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Yeah, it's common to think of targeting as you say, as a discrete act. That is, there's a point at which you identify a target and engage it. So that focuses attention on the proverbial tip of the spear, you know, the point at which a target is attacked. Now, the significance of that is for ethical purposes, that frames the ethical issue with regard to AI and AI-enabled weapons as whether a human or a machine conducts the attack, or in some cases, whether a human or machine selects the target and then attacks it. Does the machine have authority, if you will, to identify a target and then attack it without a human being involved in that process? So from this perspective, you know, many claim that we can ensure ethical use of AI-enabled weapons by making sure that a human is in the loop, as the term goes, at that moment of attack. So that's thinking of AI as a discrete act. In fact, the targeting process consists of a number of different steps that lead up to that final step of execution. And for U.S. and NATO targeting, for instance, there are six stages. I won't go into all the details involving each, but I'll just list them. One is, first of all, establishing commander's intent with respect to potential targeting and translating that into specific operational tasks. Then is an important stage, what's called target development, validation, nomination, and setting priorities among targets. And that's where AI can be especially significant. But again, we're a few steps left of bang, so to speak, before execution. And then third is capabilities, determining the right asset with which to engage the target. Fourth, there's a final approval of the target list and then assigning those to different force components to plan targeting missions. Then there's actually mission planning and execution. This is the point at which a target is attacked after identifying it, tracking it, fixing a weapon on it, and then releasing the weapon. And that's the point at which many people believe that that's where the ethical issue arises. And then finally, afterward, you conduct a battle damage assessment to evaluate the effectiveness of the operation. So what's the significance of thinking of targeting in those terms as a process? Well, we may use AI at each step of this process. And the situational awareness of the person at the execution phase is likely going to be shaped significantly by interactions between machine outputs and humans at prior phases. And it's conceivable, depending on how that process is organized, that by the time things get to the point where we've got an operator ready to engage, there may be little room for the exercise of human judgment. In other words, that operator's situational awareness is shaped so significantly by machine outputs that precede and provide information and perhaps recommendations to that person, that that person may not really be in a position to add an increment of human judgment, and so will defer to the machine. So bottom line is, it's important that we appreciate that in each of those steps that I described, particularly the first five leading up to execution, that we may well be using AI. So we need to think about, how is it that humans and machines sort of divide up the work at each of those stages? And to what extent at each of those stages is that work divided up appropriately? To what extent are humans able to evaluate the outputs of the machine and contribute their own judgment so that at each step of the process, you know, that operator can be confident that there have been humans and not just machines that have provided the basis for his or her situational awareness.
So, Mitt, that's quite interesting. And let's see if we can relate that to the medical field, because in fact, with AI today, a radiologist, for instance, who is looking at a tumor may have looked at thousands of tumors. But when he or she uses the AI to make a judgment on the state of that tumor, that AI might have looked at, or it has looked at, millions, if not tens of millions of tumors. And how do you know? Mm-hmm. Is this the same thing, that the AI might be that much smarter than the human being in terms of making that determination all across the process?
That's an excellent question, Michael. And the scenario you describe is, in fact, a very real one. And so, to take the example of the radiologist has experience based upon his or her own judgments and how those have played out, you know, making recommendations or providing information to someone who's going to use that information. As you say, the AI has the benefit of looking at millions of those. And so, you know, the question for the radiologist, first of all, is to understand, what is the process by which the machine, if you will, has learned to identify, let's keep it simple, a tumor? Because there, you know, the machine is only as good as the data that it's trained on. And we need to make sure that we've got, for instance, representative data. And we also need to, that radiologist, essentially sort of the equivalent of the operator in the military context, also needs to understand, well, what are the limits of what this can tell me? You know, I see that this says that with a certain probability, this is likely to be a tumor. What do I know based on my own experience? Over time, you know, there can be a tendency to assume that the machine is correct, what we call automation bias. And so what we have to think about is, you know, is there the risk that at some point we're going to sort of let the machine determine whether something is a tumor, with the human really not in a position to second guess, if you will, that. Now, in that context, the information is going to be passed on to a physician, right? But and then there may be a decision to conduct a biopsy. There may be a decision to engage in other sorts of, you know, diagnostic procedures. So it would be important before deciding, let's say, conduct surgery. So it would be important maybe to complement the information we get from the machine with information from other sources, right, that may be less machine driven. But that's that's a really excellent example of how we want to try to get the benefits of what the machine can do, but also draw to the extent we can on human judgment in assessing the performance of the machine, and then perhaps complementing the information that the machine provides with other sources of information.
Let's jump back then into the purely targeting domain. And in that domain, what does meaningful human control mean? And where in the targeting process is it really essential?
Well, meaningful human control, if we think of targeting in a process, as a process, essentially applies to every stage of that process. Or put differently, meaningful human control means not just human control at the step of execution, identify and engage a target. We have to look at the process or the system as a whole. And we have to look at it as a system, a sequence of various decisions. The U.S. Department of Defense uses the phrase appropriate levels of human judgment to capture the importance of this perspective. So what we need to do is to make sure that we ask, how well does the decision-making process taken as a whole, you know, in which outputs at one step are essentially inputs to decisions at another step. How much can we be confident that humans are aware at each of those steps of the strengths and limitations of AI to perform the tasks that we ask of it? And are humans in a position to take into account those strengths and limitations in determining how much weight to give to machine outputs and the various courses of action that they may effectively recommend? So it's a process essentially of looking at the system as a whole. And we can't necessarily say that if we have meaningful human control at one step, then we have meaningful human control, because everything feeds into everything else. I mean, there is a phase, what's called that, what I mentioned earlier, which is the target nomination, vetting, validation, and so forth, in which the use of AI is particularly significant, and that contributes in important ways to a decision to engage a target. And here I draw on the excellent work of Merel Ekelhoff, a Dutch scholar who's also done a detail at what was then the U.S. Joint AI Center. You know, at each step of the process, are we appropriately dividing up responsibilities between humans and machines such that we can say at each step of the process, human values are being incorporated into the conclusions that are drawn and the recommendations that are made for the next step?
But all of this stuff is great, but let's look at an example. For instance, an air interdiction mission. How is that idea of meaningful human control maintained throughout the targeting process? What are the ethical considerations, especially?
Yes, that's a good example of the way in which focusing on targeting as a discrete act and ensuring that there's meaningful human control at that stage doesn't really capture what's of ethical significance. And here again, I draw on Merel Ekelhoff. She provides this example of an air interdiction mission. The mission is, let's say, destroying an enemy command and control facility, dropping with an F-16 using 2,000-pound bombs, guided by joint direct attack munitions, which basically is a kit that you can put onto bombs that uses GPS to guide the bomb to the intended target. And so the operators who will fly the mission meet with the team a couple of hours before takeoff, and they're briefed on the mission. The operators are briefed on the mission. They study the data. They do the preparations. They'll get a target package that includes a description of the target, that consists of all available intelligence that we have, in this case, fairly straightforward, a C2 facility, the target's coordinates, a collateral damage estimate with an estimation of expected potential civilian casualties, or basically a weaponeering solution, that is, what's the quantity, type, mix, configuration of weapons needed to achieve the desired effects while minimizing civilian harm. Here we've got two 2,000-pound bombs guided by the JDAM. The desired point of impact to identify the ideal maximum aim points to achieve the maximum effect. And then weather conditions, right? And then, of course, you've got rules of engagement. And the process is one in which the operator basically has pre-programmed into the craft's computer the target's coordinates. The operator will then navigate to an area within the weapons envelope, that is the area within which the weapon is capable of effectively reaching the target. That's going to be guided by GPS, visualization on the operator's screen. Once the craft has detected the target, sensors will be engaged, and those will produce positive identification of the target, right, and its location. With a fixed target engaged with something like a JDAM, the operator will typically not visually confirm the target. And let's say we've got overcast conditions where that's not feasible. So they're going to rely on the aircraft systems, the weapons guidance system, the prior validation procedures at the operational planning level to ensure they're striking a legitimate military objective in a lawful way. So as Echolhoff puts it, there is no particular task during the phase of sort of fixing the location and positively identifying the target that requires the operator's attention, other than flying the aircraft to the weapons envelope. And then the target's been previously vetted. As a result, the pilot simply needs to load the target coordinates, the impact angle, velocity into the aircraft before taking off. Those coordinates and the plane's current position are fed to the computer. Once the aircraft enters the weapons envelope, the computer will suggest the most effective time to release the bomb. And the pilot simply needs to press the switch at that point to release the weapon once they fly within the weapons envelope. So as Echolhoff puts it, most of the work of finding, fixing, tracking, targeting, and engaging is not something that the operator is required to attend to. So we might ask, given that what effectively the operator does is fly to the weapons envelope and then is guided by the information as to that confirms the location of the target, that provides an indication of when best to release the bombs and the impact angle. What sort of level of human judgment does the operator contribute at that last stage? What sort of cognitive deliberation, except pressing the button once the aircraft is within the weapons envelope? Now, if we focus on, you know, whether there is sort of meaningful human control or exercise of human judgment, or just whether a human is in the loop, you know, if that's our focus and we focus only on the execution stage, we could say, well, we really don't have any sort of meaningful human control there. But the question is there meaningful human control with respect to each of the steps that produces the information that the operator relies on in order to execute the mission? And so you expand the aperture to say, well, let's not just focus on the weapons release point. Let's focus on everything that leads up to that and how AI is used in combination with humans to generate information that on which the operator can reasonably rely when releasing the weapon. So I think is a good example of how an overly narrow focus kind of leads us astray, and why it's important to focus on targeting as a process.
You know, Amit, this is interesting because if you'd ask me prior to talking to you, I would say the most important thing is whether or not a human needs to pull the trigger. What you're doing now is you're expanding that to a much broader field. A human needs to be involved with making sure that he or she understands, you know, how the weather was gotten, how the mapping information got there, how, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not as black and white as pulling the trigger or not.
That's exactly right, Michael.
Professor Amit Regan, thank you for joining us on Radio Stockdale and talking about this much broader, deeper process on how AI interacts with targeting. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Radio Stockdale, a series of podcasts produced by the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership at the United States Naval Academy. You can hear more podcasts at StockdaleCenter.com/podcasts.